I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, a risk analyst asks, should Iraq be split in two? But first, America's top commander in Iraq seemed to say today that division won't be necessary. General George Casey said some of the extra troops the president is sending to Iraq could begin returning home by late summer, and some progress on securing Iraq will be seen in the next 60 to 90 days. Well, meanwhile, militants in Iraq with links to al-Qaeda are claiming responsibility for an attack on a convoy that killed a young American democracy worker and her three guards. Borzu Daragahi joins us now. He's Baghdad correspondent for the LA Times. And Borzu, the death of 28-year-old Andrea Parhamovich is resonating here in Boston. She worked for the former Massachusetts governor, Republican Jane Swift. But then she also worked later with Al Franken at Air America Radio, worked for the International Republican Institute in Baghdad before jumping over to the National Democratic Institute.
Yeah, you know, it's a real tragedy. It's really awful. And, you know, there's a very small-knit, small, close-knit expatriate community in Iraq that's left here. And so, of course, everyone's kind of connected. Andy's serious boyfriend, who she was partly in Iraq so that she could be able to see Michael Hastings of Newsweek, is a colleague and a valued friend, and my prayers and heart are with him.
Well, and we know that you've said this before, 100 people a day now are being killed in Iraq, and you'd like to eulogize them all. But she reminds us, Andy Parhamovich, that more than 400 U.S. civilians have been killed in the war. The Boston Globe reports 75,000 of them are still in country. Are a lot of them idealistic young people like her? I mean, are you seeing others like her?
Well, it's very rare. Most of them are in the U.S. protected green zone, or they're in places, especially in northern Iraq, in the Kurdish-controlled areas, which is a lot safer. We don't see a lot of them. People keep a very low profile. And it's rather sad. There used to be a lot more in the beginning. The place was literally flooded with non-governmental organizations, nonprofits, charities of various stripes and with various duties. And so you see less and less of those idealistic people here.
Was there one moment when they began to leave? Has it been just attrition, or have they left recently?
I think the clarion call of the insurgency, the massive bombing of the UN compound in August 2003, it was a real signal to everyone here who was a do-gooder that, oh my God, you know, these insurgents are not fooling around, that this is serious business, that if the UN is targeted, why wouldn't my small NGO? Shortly thereafter, the UN compound was targeted again, and then the ICRC, the International Community of Red Cross, was targeted, a devastating bombing that killed double-digit numbers of people, and after that, the exodus began.
Tell us more about the National Democratic Institute that Andrea Parhamovich worked for. We understand it was run by Madeleine Albright, established a few decades ago, but what does it do?
Well, NDI, it does what some consider rather controversial. It goes to developing countries, new democracies, or maybe even countries that are not quite democracies, and it sets up shop. It organizes talks, it lectures, seminars, group workshops where people from political parties come. They learn about how to canvass, how to develop grassroots political skills, connect with voters, run professional campaigns, and so on. Some people consider it an arm of the U.S. foreign policy establishment, and both NDI and IRI are criticized by some, especially on the left, as being tools of American colonialism. But others see their work for what it is, which is essentially just going and teaching people who are used to dictatorship the tools of democratic organizing that we have in the States.
How are they reacting to this death?
Well, I think that they're definitely reevaluating their presence in Iraq as this kind of thing happens. Most organizations do tend to go through a reevaluation period. It remains to be seen whether they'll stay here and whether they'll continue to operate in the capacity that they have been operating. They're based in the red zone, not in the U.S. protected green zone. They travel around in protected armored convoys with Western security guards. maybe they'll reevaluate that.
Yeah. Well, as we said, a Sunni insurgent group linked with al-Qaeda is taking responsibility, saying that Andrea Parhamovic was a Mossad Zionist agent, meaning, according to some, that they don't know who she was. The Times says, though, the New York Times says she might have been targeted. Do you think she was?
I mean, Robin, this is a country where people get killed for picking up the trash because they're accused of being Zionist agents who are discovering where the roadside bombs are. So they'll pick some guy who's getting paid, you know, a couple bucks a day to pick up the trash. So, you know, doctors, lawyers, journalists, poets, singers, musicians, artists, actors, there was a whole spate of actors, athletes, everyone is targeted. So it's hard to say whether, you know, she was targeted specifically because of her work for NDI or whether she was just targeted specifically for just existing.
Borzu, in light of that, what do you think of General Casey's comments today that he expects progress on security within a month or so?
I think that that is probably something that could happen in Baghdad. The Shiite militia people that we are talking to are saying we're not going to be baited into a trap with the Americans to give them an excuse to crack down on our communities. We're going to hide our weapons, lay low, and then just wait.
But, of course, that raises the question, you know, then what? I mean, after the troops leave, they'll still be there?
Exactly. They'll still be here. I mean, the fundamental problems of Iraq are not going to be solved by this kind of kinetic operation. Fundamental problems of Iraq right now have to do with questions of national identity that are that have to be resolved politically or on the streets with guns.
Borzu Dargahi, Baghdad correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Borzu, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, risk management expert David Apgar has an idea for Iraq. He wants analysts to think outside the box, and in an effort to get them to do that, he's proposed that Iraq might be split in two. David is the author of Risk Intelligence, Learning to Manage What We Don't Know. He's also managing director of the Corporate Executive Board. That's a management research company. David, welcome.
Thanks very much, Robin.
Well, let's start at the very beginning, David. As you well know, when people think of Iraq, they don't think two, they think three major ethnicities, the Sunni, the Kurds, and the Shia. And Senator Joe Biden and others have talked about a three-state solution to Iraq. So first of all, what do you think is wrong or could possibly cause problems with a three-state solution?
The first is that it relies on a promise to share oil. If you think about the situation of the Kurds and Sunnis, if one group ends up not getting oil, it will want to fight.
And it would be the Sunnis who would be cut out of the oil reserves because the area they would get, where they live, the reserves aren't there.
That's right. They're closer to Kurdish territory. Another problem is that if you've got a Kurdish state on Turkey's border, you know, at some point, the Turkish army might well feel compelled to invade a purely Kurdish state, if only because some of its domestic Kurdish rebels would try to use Kurdish Iraq as a refuge. You'd also have to find some way to divide Baghdad. I mean, you know, how would you go about dividing Boston in two parts? And finally, a purely Shiite state could also be unstable because, you know, there are very, very different population segments within Iraq's Shiite population.
And this is one of the most fascinating things that you remind us of, because you say that actually there are four segments within Iraq, and two of them are Shia. Explain that.
There are Shia in Baghdad. A lot of them are very poor. A lot of them are followers of Muqtada Sadr, and that is a population that is used to living a city life. In the south, you've got what seems to be a much more traditional population, more rural, and it is centered on most of the Shiite holy sites. And those two groups have already started to see some friction, especially as fighting has emerged outside of Basra in the very south of Iraq.
And there are two leaders. You mentioned Muqtada al-Sadr, who is with the more urban Shia in Baghdad, and then in the south it's al-Sistani.
That's right. Sistani is a religious leader, very much respected. There's a political leader who's more closely associated with him, Hakim. And there's, in fact, there's already some competition between Hakim and Sadr.
All right. Well, let's take a look at your two-state solution and see how that might solve some of the problems that you see on the horizon that might come up between the Shias. Lay out, first of all, the border for us. And as you do that, would you just remind us, I mean, we'll close our eyes and picture Iraq. Where are these different groups? And then where would your border run?
My proposal would run a border from southwest to northeast, and it would run near Baghdad's airport, which is south of the city. It's outside of the metropolitan area. This line would basically split the country into two even parts in terms of population.
Describe the north to us. It would have the Kurds in the north. Baghdad would be there?
Right. The state to the north or to the northwest would include all of Iraq's approximately 5 million Kurds, and nearly all of its approximately 5 million Sunni as well. Also, it would include all of Baghdad, and it would include the 2 to 3 million urban Shia in metropolitan Baghdad. And finally, it would include all of the northern oil fields, which are in the city of Kirkuk, just outside or really on the edge of Kurdish territory.
Before we describe the southern state, how would this solve some of the problems that you talked about? For instance, Muqtada al-Sadr, he would be in a minority of Shia. Why would that be good for him?
One of the most interesting things about a two-way split is that it arguably offers the best possible development solution for people in places like Sadr City, which is a Shiite slum in the east of Baghdad. It's true that, as you say, Shia would comprise a small part of the northern state. They'd be just 20% of the northern state. The important thing about the northern state is that no population group would have a majority by itself. That's what would keep it stable. Kurds in the north would be about 40%. Sunnis in the north would be about 40%. And the Shia in the northern state would be the other 20%. The Shia would probably be the kingmakers in a situation like this, supporting Kurdish or Sunni political parties, mm-hmm. basically depending on the attention that those parties paid to the development needs of Baghdad's urban poor. This is really important in terms of understanding what's going on right now in Iraq, because that means that the Shia in Baghdad, who are the one who are taking the brunt of insurgent action by Sunni militants, they would no longer represent the vanguard of a community of 15 million Shia throughout the country as they do today. And that community of 15 million Shia threatened the livelihood of Iraq Sunnis. No surprise, they're furious with the Sunnis and resentful of them because of the way the Shia suffered under Saddam.
And now the majority of Shias would make up the southern state, this huge agrarian Shia population. And you write that what that would do for Muqtada al-Sadr, first of all, it would take away the conflict that he might have with those agrarian Shia, while still giving him an opportunity to be, as you said, some sort of kingmaker, because he could side with the Kurds or with the Sunni, depending on which political outcome works better for him.
Right. Sadr has repeatedly shown interest in working across sectarian lines. And the reason may be that he fears that a purely Shiite state would marginalize him. And it also might marginalize his poorer followers in the city. But if you think about it, all of the groups in the northern state I described, including the urban Shia, seem to be more inclined to live in an open state, a state more open than any that Saddam would allow. The Shia in the south appear to be much more traditional. That whole country would be anchored in the holy sites, the Shiite holy sites of Karbala and Najaf. They would probably prefer a more traditional lifestyle and perhaps Sharia law.
That's risk management expert David Apgar with him. More about his outside-the-box idea to divide Iraq in two after the break. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with David Apgar, author of Risk Intelligence, Learning to Manage What We Don't Know. He's also an editor for the online magazine The Globalist, and he's saying, think outside the box on Iraq. Now, Peter Galbraith, former ambassador to Croatia, Senator Joe Biden, and others have suggested breaking Iraq into three, with a region for the Kurds, another the Shia, another Sunni Arabs. David says, how about two, with the Kurds, Sunnis, and some Shia from Baghdad in one region, and then the more conservative, more religious Shia with their own state in the south. So, David, let's continue. You say the southern Shia would have oversight of many of the religious sites. It would allow them to have a more conservative government, which they would want. But the oil-rich area remains in the north, doesn't it? Does the south get any oil?
Yes, there are oil fields outside of Basra, maybe amounting to 55% or even a little more of the total oil in Iraq. So this two-way split comes close to splitting Iraq's oil reserves in two parts as well. In other words, the two states would be self-sufficient in terms of oil resources. And that's a large reason to consider it. Of course, the other reason to consider it is, what does it do for the other population groups, including the Kurds and the Sunnis?
Well, I was going to say, for the Kurds, it would seem as if this division would take the pressure of a possible intervention by Turkey off of their shoulders. They'd still have some autonomy, but they'd share it. They'd share their space with Sunnis and some Shia.
The state in the north would be 40% Kurdish. Kurds would have the same ability to pursue autonomy as they have in a unified Iraq, but they would have uncompromised access to the oil in the north. And because 60% of that state would be Arab, there would be no purely Kurdish state on Turkey's border. In fact, Turkey could not irresponsibly provoke any kind of conflict with the Kurds because they would be dealing with a state that in fact was 60% Arab.
We're talking to David Apgar. He's the author of Risk Intelligence, Learning to Manage What We Don't Know. And he's taking a different view at the possible future of Iraq if, in fact, the plan over the next couple of years to bring full democracy to Iraq as we know it doesn't work out. And he's encouraging people to think outside the box. But David, you know, one last question for you. You know that neighboring countries don't like the idea of a split up Iraq. They're afraid that it might unhinge ethnic tensions within their own countries. The White House has said they are adamant that they don't want the country to break up in any way. James Baker, you know, one of the advisors, is famous for being wary of splitting up nations. He wasn't in favor of the Soviet Union splitting up. From your perspective, which is the perspective, you know, of risk intelligence and management, why do you think this kind of thinking is important?
I think that we are all facing, both the administration, the American public, and the neighbors around Iraq, the possibility of a complete fracture of the population there, which would be worse from everyone's perspective. The risk perspective, I think, is an important one. My book, Risk Intelligence, is really more about strategy than risk, because most risk books are about mitigating risk. Think of, nailing boards over windows. But we adapt to most risks. We cope with them by learning. And you can learn about any new set of risks and increase that rate of learning. Now, consider how little we've learned about the political preferences of Iraqis. Think, what kind of body count has had to build up of Iraqis for us to learn that post-dictatorial Iraq, as a unified country, basically poses a mortal threat to most Sunnis? At the present, they're looking at being a 20% minority and a hated one. And, of course, even the most reasonable people in a situation like that will consider, strapping, a bomb to the chassis of their car. So we aren't learning about political needs fast enough. And, there's an expression that you need to kill off your worst ideas before they kill you. And we're really literally seeing people being killed by an idea that doesn't seem to work, a unified Iraq post-Saddam. We need to learn about new alternatives, and the only way we can is to put new ideas forward, lots of them, and ask Iraqis to debate them.
David Apgar, again, the author of Risk Intelligence, Learning to Manage What We Don't Know. He's also a managing director of the Corporate Executive Board, a management research company, and he's a contributing editor to The Globalist. He's been speaking to us from Washington. David, thanks for provoking some thoughts.
Thanks very much, Robin. I sure appreciate your interest.
Quick note, it's called a pre-buttal, and today the two Democrats who now lead Congress delivered it at a press conference, an attack on policies they expect President Bush to defend or propose in his State of the Union speech on Tuesday. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid warned the president that he does not have the authority to launch military action against Iran without congressional approval, and Reid was asked whether he expected the president to soften his stance on issues such as global warming.
Well, we found the president in his first 6 years to be pretty stubborn. And we found the last few weeks as much change as has been in the first 6 years. He's backed off in the domestic spying. He has acknowledged many mistakes in Iraq. And there are rumblings from the White House that in this speech that he's going to give on Tuesday, he's going to talk about energy and he's going to even talk about global warming. If he doesn't, it's really too bad.
And in a striking moment, community activist Reverend Lennox Yearwood demanded to know if Congress was going to extend the 18-month deadline for housing benefits for Hurricane Katrina victims.
We have survivors who are dying in the streets. And so this is serious to the black community.
Okay. Speaker Pelosi, would you like to answer the question that's implied there?
It will be put out in the streets again. Will anything be done in the Senate and the House to extend the 18-month deadline?
As I mentioned in my comments about Katrina, this is a serious challenge to the conscience of our country. Our committee, Barney Frank, the chair of the Committee of Jurisdiction, working with Maxine Waters, who is the chair of the Housing Subcommittee, are quickly taking up this matter.
That was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in a State of the Union pre-buttal and press conference this morning. Well, tell you what, we are going to switch gears. We're going to get in the armchair and talk football and Oscar picks. That's still ahead here and now. Stay with us. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Former Ohio Congressman Bob Ney has been sentenced to 30 months in federal prison for his role in the Jack Abramoff congressional bribery scandal. As Ney heads to prison, ethics reform is back on track in Congress. After failing once earlier this week, senators then voted to make themselves more accountable for pet projects they sneak into bills and to end the practice of receiving travel and gifts from lobbyists. But they probably won't stop one gift tradition, the so-called candy desk. It's a desk in the very back row near the busy Senate elevator, and it's packed with donated sweets from the home state of the senator who sits there for all senators to help themselves. It's become a part of the lore of the Senate, where some of the desks date back to the early 1800s. So joining us first is Betty Coet. She's assistant historian in the Senate Historical Office. And Betty, remind us, the desks in general in the Senate, when were they built?
Well, about 45 of them date back to 1819, which is when the Capitol was reconstructed after the fire. You remember the British troops burned the Capitol in 1814, and it went through a five-year period of reconstruction, and they had to replace all the desks at that time. So 45 or 46 of the desks date to that time. And then as new states came in, they would create new desks that resembled the old.
So these are very special desks. And
they are.
The candy desk, in particular, as a candy desk, has a relatively recent history.
Yes, it does. When Senator George Murphy of California came into office in 1965, he began to stock his desk with candy because he had a sweet tooth.
Mm-hmm.
And as time would go by, other members of the Senate began to realize that his desk was always stocked with candy, and they began to stop by and help themselves as well. Through the years, it's gotten a little more institutionalized, and over the last 15 to 20 years, American candy makers have been donating candy to keep the supplies stocked.
And I understand that Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum sat there for about a decade, which was lucky for senators because Pennsylvania has a rich history of candy.
That's right. I mean, typically it would go to a junior member because it is a back row seat, and as you know, as they gain seniority, they move towards the front of the chamber. But Senator Santorum chose to stay there for a second term and keep the tradition of the candy desk going. And because he's from Pennsylvania, he had plenty of supplies to bring.
Well, then he was defeated in November. Mm-hmm. And now Craig Thomas sits there, and he is from Wyoming. And that is where the problem presents itself. Because why?
Well, because Wyoming is not known for its candy making. The fact that Wyoming doesn't have a big Hershey's factory or a Godiva chocolate factory or that type of thing that's become so associated with the desk over the last 10 years during Santorum's tenure there. So they've had to start looking around at local candy makers in Wyoming and smaller scale candy makers to see where the supplies for the desk may come from.
And that raises the ethics problem because the rules forbid members from accepting gifts worth $100 or more a year from a single source, unless they're from a senator's home state and those gifts are, you know, manufactured in the home state and then given to other senators. Well, Wyoming doesn't have a company big enough to make the donation, is what I understand.
Mm-hmm. That has been the problem, and I think they've come up with a solution that sort of combines the efforts of several of the smaller candy makers in Wyoming. But you're quite quite correct that the ethics rules are quite strict on that. But if it's a home state manufacturer or a home state company, the rules are looser, and so they can get larger contributions from those types of companies because it promotes a home state business.
By the way, can you describe this? I mean, what is it, drawers that pull out, you know, big wooden drawers that pull out and filled with candy?
Well, the Senate desks resemble old writing desks, and so they have a lift-up top that has space underneath there for pencils and papers and that type of thing. Think of an old-time school writing desk. That's what they look like. Below that part, there's a single drawer that pulls out, and that's what's filled with candy. So it doesn't take a huge amount of candy to fill it up. It's not a very big drawer.
Well, I've seen a picture. It looks like it's just overflowing with candy. It looks fabulous, frankly. And we know that some of the items that the Wyoming candy makers, these small candy makers, make include, moose doodles. You're supposed to, it's like a chocolate, we call them turtles sometimes, but I guess they're supposed to look like moose droppings. Bison balls. Rice Krispies that are dipped in chocolate. Now, some of these candy makers are saying they can't afford to give them for free. So, as you said, there's negotiations going on right now. But how do you think the Senate will respond to, instead of, Hershey's Kisses, having, chocolate mousse droppings?
Well, it'll be interesting to see. When the news first went out that the desk was going to go to Senator Thomas of Wyoming, there were lots of jokes going around about cactus candy and that type of thing, and a lot of interest in terms of just what these local candy makers will come up with. And so I think we may see more traffic than ever before at the candy desk as they try out the new things.
Betty, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Betty Coed, Assistant Historian in the Senate Historical Office. Well, time now for a few of your thoughts, and boy did we hear them after our conversation with Richard Perle, former chair of the Pentagon Advisory Panel, the Defense Policy Board. Perle objected to my saying that he pushed for war in Iraq. Well, Diane Gurian of Intervale, New Hampshire writes, I wanted to reach through my radio and throttle Richard Perle as he backpedaled and obfuscated about his pre-war assertions. He is only one of several muscular proponents of this disaster who now demur and disavow their former views. Hats off to you for keeping your cool. Well, Claire Durst of Barrington, Rhode Island, pointed out that Perle had been a signatory of the 1998 letter to President Clinton calling for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. And she also sent a quote from 2002, a PBS special, in which Perle said of an impending war in Iraq, it isn't going to be over in 24 hours, but it isn't going to be months either. And David DeVoe of Essex, Massachusetts, adds, the arrogance of that guy is breathtaking. It reminds me of the old bumper sticker that reads, I thought I was wrong once, but I was mistaken. Well, we also heard from many of you after we spoke with Sharon Cooper, a pediatrician at the University of North Carolina. She explained why kids like the Missouri teen Sean Hornbeck might not leave an abductor even if they physically can.
Very often, self-blame, shame, and a belief in the brainwashing, if you will, that has been provided to them since he was less than 12 years of age, his family would be harmed or that his family wasn't even alive anymore.
Well, Jane Austin of Delaware County, Pennsylvania, agreed and said, remember the cults. She writes, my kids were once members of a cult. Initially, brainwashing involved love bombing, constant admiration, then sleep deprivation, threats. Sean seems the way they were, and if so, he would never try to run away, as my kids didn't. And finally, after we visited with Joshua Bell, whose new CD is called Voice of the Violin, we heard from George Villirolo of Brookline, Massachusetts. He writes, I was reminded of the Sicilian novelist Andrea Camilleri, whose fourth installment in his delightful Inspector Montalbano mystery series is entitled Voice of the Violin. Here's a small passage. It seemed to him as if the violin had suddenly become a voice, a woman's voice, begging to be heard and understood. Slowly but surely the notes turned into syllables, and yet they expressed a kind of lament, a song of ancient suffering that at moments reached searing, mysteriously tragic heights. And this stirring female voice told of a terrible secret that could only be understood by someone capable of abandoning himself entirely to the sound, the waves of sound. Phew. Well, you can write too. Send emails to here-now.org, voicemails to 617-358-0397. You're listening to Here and Now. So I'm trying to remember, anything going on this weekend? Oh, that's right. Football, a big weekend. That's why I'm yelling. The conference championship games on Sunday cap a playoff season full of dramatic endings and strong comebacks from some of the league's major stars. I, of course, will be glued to my set for the Patriots game, an uncomfortable position that, glued to your set. But apparently others are playing as well, so we bring in Tom Curran, sports writer for the Providence Journal and the NFL columnist for NBCSports.com for a look ahead. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin. How are you?
I'm good, and I will be watching the Patriots, but the team everyone's been following on its rise from the ashes of New Orleans, the Saints. They play the Bears at Chicago's Soldier Field on Sunday. Now, Virginia, our producer here, tells me that everyone in New Orleans is going to be saying, who dat said they're going to beat them Saints?
Exactly right.
What do you think? Look at that game.
I don't think that the Bears are going to be able to beat them Saints. I really don't. I mean, if you want to get into the fundamentals and the X's and O's, the Saints have a very explosive offense. In addition, the Bears haven't been playing very stable going into the playoffs. They won last week, but they have a real problem at quarterback. And I think that, as I wrote this morning, what happened post-Katrina and the rebuilding of that city doesn't help people knock Chicago Bears to the ground or help passes be completed or runs made. But there is a level of momentum, Robin, that I think that they're all working with right now.
Plus, they have the league's top passer, Drew Brees.
He's been unbelievable. I mean, he was injured last year. He went to New Orleans almost, you know, as a reclamation project, and he's been terrific. They also have Reggie Bush, who won the Heisman Trophy last year, and Deuce McAllister, who's a Louisiana native, actually Mississippi native, went to Ole Miss, and just a terrific guy and a tremendous guy. If you're watching that game, try and get the story on Deuce McAllister, who really is an uplifting guy.
Mm. Well, the Indianapolis Colts will face the New England Patriots in the AFC conference on Sunday. A writer here, Clark Booth, had a great phrase. You know, the Patriots beat the Chargers last weekend, and he said if the Chargers were a fish, the Patriots would have to throw him back because they shouldn't have won. But now it's been being said, looking at the game ahead, that the Patriots own the Colts in the playoffs. What does that mean?
They just have a mastery over them from coaching staff to on-field play, and it dates back through the playoffs from 2003 and 2004, in which the Colts came into these games, AFC Championship or playoff games, having scored about 45 points a game. And in both games, they went into New England, into Foxborough, in the snow, and were embarrassed. Mm. The thing that's flipped this year, Robin, is the fact that they're playing indoors at the RCA Dome. Of
at
course.
Home, right. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And Adam Vinatieri, who, you know, was a prominent fixture for the Patriots.
No.
So
he's now with the Colts.
He's with the Horseshoes now.
Oh, boy.
So things have changed.
But they also have quarterback Peyton Manning. But will he be continue to be known as, you know, the quarterback everybody loves, great statistics, but, you know, maybe can't win that big game?
Sadly for Peyton, he probably will, because the situation with him is the more duress, the more pressure you can put him under when he's dropping back and trying to find receivers down the field, the better off it will be for the opponent. And the Patriots have done a tremendous job of doing that. In the two playoff games that the Colts have had, they've only scored one touchdown offensively. Peyton Manning has a touchdown and five interceptions. This is not a good way to go into a game against New England.
Well, and the Patriots, we have to say, have Tom Brady. I found myself stranded in an airport last weekend, something I've never done before, yelling out in a pub. Some guy in the pub said, hey, I guess Tom Brady's not that good. And after that wonderful win over the Chargers, I find myself yelling out, I guess Tom Brady is that good. Is he that good?
He is backed up by statistics, Robin, and backed up by firsthand exposure to the great ones. He's the best quarterback who's ever played the game, and I could very easily make that argument. He's won three Super Bowls in four seasons. Now he's working on four and six seasons. He's 12 and one in the playoffs. Joe Montana never put up that record. Otto Graham never did that. Bart Starr, anybody you want to trot out, has never been as successful in the postseason nor as efficient in the regular season as Tom Brady.
Well, that's Tom Curran, NFL columnist for NBCSports.com, and I don't know, maybe he is partial because he's from Rhode Island. But we'll see what happens this weekend, Tom.
Hey, enjoy it, Robin.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Academy Award nominations will be announced next week, and after this week's Golden Globe Awards, Helen Mirren and Forrest Whitaker top the list for Best Bet for Best Acting. They both play real-life rulers. Dame Mirren stars in The Queen as Elizabeth II, unwilling to listen to the pleas of Prime Minister Tony Blair that she respond publicly to the death of Princess Diana.
I doubt there is anyone who knows the British people more than I do, Mr. Blair, nor who has greater faith in their wisdom and judgment. And it is my belief that they will any moment reject this mood, which is being stirred up by the press, in favor of a period of restrained grief and sober private mourning.
Forrest Whitaker embodies the former despot of Uganda, Idi Amin, in The Last King of Scotland. Here he is addressing a crowd with the populist spirit that first endeared Idi Amin to his people before they felt his psychotic rage.
I may wear the uniform of a general, but Queen Yemoyo Wangu, in my heart, I am a simple man like you. I know who you are and everything that you are. I am you.
But frankly, any of 7 or 8 movies could get a Best Picture nod. And will this year be the one that long overlooked but highly acclaimed director Martin Scorsese finally takes home the statue for The Departed, or The Departed, as we say here in Boston? Here to talk about the Oscar nominations, Here Now pop culture critic Renee Graham. Nice to see you, Renee.
Good to see you too, Robin.
Well, Renee, let's start with Best Actress. And should Helen Mirren just start practicing her speech?
They should just be engraving her name on the statue right now. You know, Meryl Streep is very good in Devil Wears Prada, but this is Helen Mirren's year. She has pretty much swept every award possible. She's won everything short of the World Series this year. And you know, she might win the Super Bowl. Who knows? It's just been that kind of year for her. And it's a remarkable performance.
Who else might be in the category?
Penelope Cruz for Volvaire, which is a really good performance, and I really like this movie a lot. Judi Dench, Notes on a Scandal, and you can't always count out Judi Dench because she's just that good all the time. Kate Winslet and Little Children, a film a lot of people haven't seen, but people really like her performance in this movie.
Based on the novel.
Right.
Well, let's talk about Best Actor. Besides Forrest Whitaker, who else might get the nomination? I have to say, I was really struck by Leonardo DiCaprio as an undercover cop in The Departed. But then he might be running against himself?
Leo had a very good year. He got 2 nominations, Golden Globe nominations, for both The Departed and Blood Diamond. Very, very different roles that I think showed a lot of his versatility. Peter O'Toole's a possibility for Venus, a film people haven't seen but has been getting some good notices. Will Smith in The Pursuit of Happiness, not a film I particularly like, but a film that's done very well. But I think Leo won't get 2 nominations because I actually think that Sacha Baron Cohen might get a Best Actor nomination for Borat.
No.
I think it's possible. It's about the Best Actor, and really, who gave a more convincing performance this year than Sacha Baron Cohen as Borat?
He fooled all of America.
He fooled all of America, including the women we're going to hear in this next clip.
Do you think a woman should be educated?
Definitely.
But is it not a problem that a woman have a smaller brain than a man?
That is wrong.
But the government scientist Dr. Yamak have proved it is size of squirrel.
He's wrong.
Give me a smile, baby. Why angry face?
Well, what you're saying is very demeaning.
Okay, there's Sacha Baron Cohen, Borat. There could be bedlam at the Oscars if he wins.
It would be fantastic if he wins. It would be just a shock.
Just to watch it, right?
And just to watch. It's worth having him win just to see what speech he would give.
Okay, well, Martin Scorsese might not be happy because he directed The Departed, Leonardo DiCaprio, and so many other male actors in that. A story that has eerie similarities to a true story here in Boston of Whitey Bulger, a gang leader who infiltrated the police and the FBI. Let's listen to a scene.
I'm getting on a plane unless you put Queenan on the phone.
Queenan had a funeral to go to, okay? This is my shift. Just calm down.
Eat up? You actually want me dead? Look, there is a rat in your unit. That is a fact, all right?
Where's Queenan?
He's not here.
They knew you had cameras in the building. They knew everything, all right? There was a leak from the inside. It's real, man. Smoke him out.
Scorsese picked up a Golden Globe. You feel this is his year. Why?
This has got to be his year. He's been nominated. He's gotten 6 Oscar nominations overall, 5 of them for Best Director, and he's lost every single time. That's remarkable when you consider that this is a man who's directed films such as Taxi Driver, Goodfellas, and Raging Bull.
But would they say, will they perhaps say, oh, The Departed, sort of the same thing?
No, I mean, I think it's his time. He's turning 65 this year. The Departed, I believe, was his biggest commercial hit, which is saying a lot for someone who's been making movies for almost 30 years. He lost $1 Million Baby a few years ago.
His film was The Aviator.
And his film was The Aviator. And he lost also in 2003 when he directed Gangs of New York. It just seems like it's time for him. And this would be a makeup Oscar for all the Oscars he hasn't won.
It's sort of the Gangs of Boston,
The Gangs of Boston.
We should throw in, if you liked that film, or maybe even if you didn't, you have just a sidebar thought on that film.
I think The Departed is a very good film, but personally, I prefer the Hong Kong film on which it was based called Infernal Affairs, which was directed by Andrew Lau and Alan Mack. Came out in 2000 and just an absolutely wonderful film. A lot less buddy and so much more subtle than I think The Departed. I think it's okay. Just a better film.
All right. Renee, we want to get your thoughts on Best Picture, but first, the Oscars were moved up from the end of March to the end of February a few years back, and it shortens the voting season. And we've been reading that that's damaged the voting process because Oscar voters don't get to see what they're going to be voting on. Now, most people, really, they don't care about the process. They want to know what's in the envelope. But what do you think?
I'm fine with it. I think that the Oscar voters will see the films. They're going to get the films and screeners. They'll have special screenings set up for them. And if they're so inclined, they will see the films. I think the issue is that the people who watch the Academy Awards will not have seen a lot of these films. And I think that's a case with films like Letters from Iwo Jima, the Clint Eastwood film, possibly Children of Men starring Clive Owen, which has been getting good notices, but a lot of people haven't seen. And even something like Notes on a Scandal.
All right, then. Well, let's talk about Best Picture. Drum roll, please. The Golden Globes honor Dreamgirls as Best Picture Musical or Comedy. Babel won the Best Drama. But a lot of people are talking about Little Miss Sunshine, Clint Eastwood's Letters from Iwo Jima, and there's that Departed. So what do you think?
I think Little Miss Sunshine definitely gets in there. Everyone likes the little sleeper hit, and this was the sort of small independent hit of the year.
This was about the little girl going to a beauty pageant in the van that wouldn't start.
Steve Carell and Toni Collette and just tons and tons of really forced quirk, which didn't work for me, but seemed to really be appreciated by a lot of people. So I think that possibly gets a Best Picture nod. Babel, certainly, which won the Golden Globe for Best Dramatic Motion Picture.
Babel, actually separate stories of people in Japan, a couple including Brad Pitt traveling in a foreign country.
Think Crash, but around the world.
That's right. It just global. Mexicans crossing the border. Just an amazing movie. We had the director here, Alejandro Iñárritu. And
The Departed, absolute shoo-in. You also can't count out The Queen because this is Helen Mirren's year. And Letters from Iwo Jima. I really think, Clint Eastwood had a really big year. He did Flags of Our Fathers and he did Letters from Iwo Jima, which is these sort of bookended World War II films, one told from the American viewpoint and one told from the Japanese viewpoint. And even though I don't think a lot of people saw those films, I think it has to be recognized. So I wouldn't be surprised if Letters from Iwo Jima gets in there as a Best Picture nominee.
Well, I'm going to go way out on a limb here. I think Jennifer Hudson, heartrending as the rejected Effie in Dreamgirls, is going to get a nomination.
She's pretty much a lock at this point.
It's sort of like turning the film story upside down by letting the girl that gets kicked out of the van be the one to actually take home the prize.
It's like the real Rocky story. There it is, up from never, and she's already got a Golden Globe win, and she will be hearing her name next week as an Oscar nominee.
Okay, Renee, let's sing. Here now, pop culture critic Renee Graham, her thoughts on the Oscar nominations. And I am telling you, that we always appreciate it, Renee. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Come on, admit it, you sing this in the shower. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.